Welcome to episode 482 of Troubadours and Raconteurs with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. On this week's go-round, we feature escape artist, actress, and writer Annie Sanger. We talk with Annie from her place in New York City about her journey, the flute, Summer Shakespeare, coming together, Iris Murdoch, role-playing, working against biases, the Brooklyn strategist, Fiasco's conservatory, being an escape artist, her one-woman Hamlet, who you are to yourself and who you are to society, among other things. A grand conversation with Annie Sanger. We also have an EW essay titled Afghans, and we share a brand new radio play written by our associate producer, Dr. Michael Pavese, called I Never See a Chipmunk. And we have a poem titled Green Bush. All of this, of course, will be infused, imbued with the wonderful energy of several great tunes. It is so nice to be with you. Let's get to it then. Episode 482 of Troubadours and Raconteurs. Thank you. Afghans. I am an escape artist called by the number 4. Not too sure about what is more strange. The news I read or the post-apocalyptic shows that I watch on the television. Produced for my entertainment, ceremonial scenes of human worship and fairy tale dreams. I'd like to make sense of it all, but I have COVID again. So does my friend. We were together last week drinking beers and smoking joints, like when we were in high school. What is my point? Lazy days working hard in the home office or in the backyard. People coming and going all of the time. Listening to the wind blow and ring the wind chimes. Hanging from the flagpole. I seek to feel whole, though not really interested in all there might be to know. My stomach hurts, my throat is sore. I keep walking around, going in and out of doors. This is a blessing. The calculus of it all is knitted into the several Afghan blankets made by hand, folded and laying on top of my big brown L-shaped couch. The verve is in the nerve we have to live our precious lives. The happiness of wisdom and laughter and dance. Humble in meditation to stay and work it all through the warm, hot, cold path of what could be true for me and you. Hello, Annie Sanger. Is that you?
Sanger, that's exactly right. You got it right.
Thanks so much for being on Troubadours and Rock on Tours.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. This is very exciting.
Oh, me too. Let me get started by sharing a little background with the listeners. Annie Sanger is an escape artist who loves nothing more than to make up a world and disappear into it. She is an actress and writer who specializes in irreverent takes on classical texts in the pursuit of capturing the flexibility of potential thought and putting it on stage. Currently training at Fiasco's 9-week conservatory, she received her BA in English and Theater Studies from Yale University and trained in classical acting at the British American Drama Academy. She also works as a professional dungeon master and role-playing games specialist at the Brooklyn Strategist Game Store. And you can hear her play D&D on Radio Free Brooklyn's Gameplay Radio with Aaron Levine. Aaron's cool, by the way. Troubadours and Rock on Tours is happy to have on the program Annie Sanger.
Hi.
Hi.
Definitely agree. Aaron is indeed cool.
Oh, yeah. She's very helpful to me, too, when I have problems with getting things going with Radio Free Brooklyn, maybe uploading a file or whatever. She knows what she's doing. She's awesome. Anyhow, let's get started. Let's start from the beginning, I guess. Tell us a little bit about your background, your journey, so to speak. How you got, where you come from originally? Maybe you're a New Yorker originally or
not? I absolutely am. Actually, I meet people and the two questions I get are you a New Yorker and are you an only child? Maybe a little bit of an insult, but hey, I'll take it in stride. I am decidedly a New Yorker. If anyone has a suggestion, I recently found out I need to be gluten-free. So if anyone has a suggestion for a gluten-free bagel, please feel free to reach out. I am on that quest. I grew up in New York. My parents are both lovers of arts in many ways. They're both writers. And my mom actually teaches at Tisch. She teaches not acting, but to actors.
NYU.
NYU, the acting school. So she teaches Shakespeare. She teaches dramatic theory, autobiography, adaptation, a lot of classes that are academic looks and intellectual looks into theatrical texts. And so I grew up on stories. I mean, that was like the life's blood of the family. So that means my dad's reading me The Hobbit to go to sleep. My mom's telling me the story of Pericles, sanitized for a 5-year-old, but still. so that sort of gets you in a frame of mind where storytelling, acting, theatrical enterprises, all of that is just is really close to the heart. And when I was little, I sort of studied any kind of art I could get my hands on. I took ballet for a long time. I studied the flute for even longer. And by sixth grade, I was like going to summer camps to just do an uncut Shakespeare play. Shout out to Calhoun Summer Shakespeare. They had a program, the Calhoun School had a program uptown where every summer it was just 6 weeks to put on a show. So like the first one I was with was The Tempest. And then we did Twelfth Night. We did The Winter's Tale. I was the only eighth grader who was obsessed with Paulina that year. That was a weird thing to run into. Yes. An eighth grader obsessed with, but so be it. And I just kept doing that. I ended up going to Yale for English and theater studies. So I did a dual degree in that. Also some philosophy and some classical stuff around that. And then I've just kept going since.
Yeah. And it sounds to me like you have a great context after all the years since you're a child, to work from. To me, art and philosophy, all of psychology, spirituality, it's all intertwined. And you seem to have had a healthy dose since you're a little girl. And now, it seems to me also that you believe there's a value, and correct me if I'm wrong, with folks getting together immersed in art to try to figure out these eternal struggles and questions and the like about being a, you know, that comes with being a human.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's, for me, it's a little bit less about trying to find one answer to a question or revering a text as capable of giving that answer, and a lot more about coming together in a room where you can truly give agency to each voice in that room and lift voices that aren't being heard in a collaborative way. I think art is essential for the expression of community feeling and individual feeling as things that are both true in the specific to particular people and true for the world.
Well said. Well said.
Hey, saw that philosophy, eh? That Iris Murdoch is creeping its way out.
That, you know, and that's not a bad thing.
Gotta love Iris Murdoch.
I don't know a lot about Iris Murdoch, very, very little, but I'll have to look into her after our conversation. You have me interested now. My wife probably does. My wife teaches me a lot. I'll throw the name at her, and she'll probably say, oh, yes. Anyhow, you also get into role-playing with Dungeons and Dragons, right? Is that something you do... what dawned on me is maybe this is a very, a very creative way of paying the bills while she's pursuing other avenues that aren't so fiscally lucrative.
Absolutely. I would say I would hesitate to call any role-playing game jobs fiscally lucrative. I think that would be a bit optimistic. But I will say it's sort of like, I think of it as like if the other gigs that I hold, because I have to, you have to have a couple gigs going, are maybe fully about the fiscal side of it. The work I do with D&D, Dungeons and Dragons, and other role-playing games is somewhere in the middle. It's sort of like some creative work, some teaching work, as I often work with kids. During the year, I was running about 5 games a week for kids and then a couple for adults in the evenings. It's partly the appeal of it is sort of, yes, there's some payment there, but more it's a chance to collaborate on storytelling in the same way that a company comes together to create a world for a production, or collaborative writers will come together to all bring elements together. But it has a lessened pressure because it's all improvised, and also because it's within the structure of a game. Sure, it's about the like swords and wands and the hit points, but that's sort of a structure that you can use to lessen the pressure of artistic creation and still get to have that storytelling element around it, which I find really compelling and also a great way to, for example, in the kids' games, work against biases, challenge assumptions that the kids are coming in with, teach collaborative work, teach teamwork and leadership and critical thinking and creative thought as well, problem solving, all through a really fun game.
Excellent. Yeah, I see that too. And you said you improvise a lot when you're doing this.
Oh yeah, you gotta. There's no way, whatever you think is gonna happen in a session, it will not happen. You are never right. And that's the best part about it. There's always a new thing that happens that your players come up with that you get to react to in real time.
That's great. That's great. And these are kids, or are they adults? The gamut?
The Brooklyn Strategist, again, shout out to the Brooklyn Strategist, has a program during the year where for after school classes, parents can sign up their kids, and we have a range of like 7 to, actually it goes as young as 5 for some of the games, but 7 or 5 to like 13 for kids to come in and take classes in games. So there are chess classes, there are board game classes, especially for the younger groups. They're often games that are useful for targeting specific developmental stages, mm-hmm. and helping kids hone those skills. And then there are also more creatively slanted classes that involve playing a game and investing in a story for a long time. So for the past couple of years, I've been working with them and teaching their classes.
And when you look at D&D as compared to classical texts, obviously you're well versed and greatly experienced given your formal education and your experience. What attracts you to the classical texts? You just explained what attracts you to the D&D sort of thing. And also, what is there, what can be garnered that can't from contemporary works, if that is even true? I don't know. Well, you'll tell
me. Yeah, I don't think I would go that far, because I think I find value in both contemporary works and classical works. One of the things that I think classical works can offer to the artist is a different way of working, which is sometimes present in contemporary works, and sometimes notably not. There's a book called My Year with the Shakespeare Cult, I believe, and it's about a group who came together to sort of do like non-hierarchical, company comes together and just figures out a production Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. And the introduction of the book talks about how differently we understand theater making today than we did in Shakespeare's time. Because in Shakespeare's time, everyone would learn their part, come together, and there was no director. You figure out the staging as you go. Maybe you have someone watching from outside who isn't in the scene or who has a little bit more authority in the company saying, okay, this makes no sense. You look stupid when you're doing that. Don't do that. But you don't have a director who has a vision, who is sort of communicating that vision, placing people. And I think that advent of theater making adds a lot in. I love working with a director who has an idea and whose idea I can sort of help bring to life. That's beautiful as well. But having an opportunity to work with a text that specifically is built to be put on its feet by a group of people all working together mm-hmm. is really unique. Mm-hmm. Actually, that's one of the reasons that I'm so drawn to Fiasco. And unfortunately, by this point, the conservatory is over, but I cannot recommend it enough. Studying with them was one of the highlights of all of my acting experience and truly just one of my favorite experiences as a person.
You mentioned Fiasco, something that I mentioned in the bio. It's a 9-week conservatory that happens, I guess, in the summer. Where is it?
Actually, so Fiasco Theater Company is a New York-based theater company. You'll know them from such things as Into the Woods and Merrily We Roll Along. Mm-hmm. But they started as a group of 6 actors who put on Shakespeare plays. And they first rose to prominence with Cymbeline all the way back in, I was in maybe 8th or 9th grade. When was that? Somewhere around 2012, maybe. Mm-hmm. 2011. Years are hard. I'm getting old. But somewhere around then, they put on a 6-person Cymbeline that changed how I thought about theater making, how I thought about theater, how I thought about what I wanted my life to be. I adored it. It was chaotic. Everyone was playing multiple parts, trading in and out of things, finding new physicalities, and really just letting the text shine, following it completely. So there wasn't really a set. It was them and a table and some other pieces of furniture and a washboard. But they didn't need to be, because they were making the world with their bodies and their shared understanding of what the text was saying. And they're glorious. I love them dearly, and I think they're amazing. And recently, they piloted the conservatory program right before the pandemic started with a 6-week program, but they had to delay until this year to come back. And then they had a second coming of the conservatory program for a 9-week conservatory this year. And I was lucky enough to be accepted into it and to train with them for 9 glorious weeks. which ended in May.
Ah, I see. So it ended in May, and is it in Manhattan or?
It is. It's in Manhattan. We had a space in Midtown, and
Yeah, and you know, it sounds so invigorating. Everything that you're describing, that you work within, everything you involve yourself, and I think. In our society general, outside of Manhattan, outside of all of the metropolitan areas that are more apt to have these sorts of programs, we are lacking these sorts of programs in other smaller communities. And I think those communities maybe are missing out, and maybe as a larger society, it keeps us from developing in ways that, you know, better ways than I think we would if we did have these kinds of programs. What do you think about that?
Well, I think perhaps it's not, I wouldn't find my own answer to that. I wouldn't find that to be my own conclusion. I would maybe adjust a little and say, I think for me, I'm lucky enough to have found one group of people who wish to make art and communicate with each other in the way that I would like to do. But I think every place in the world comes up with their own answer to that, their own way for people to come together and tell stories, however those stories end up manifesting. I think Dungeons and Dragons and role-playing games came from the same impulse, but I would not say that until recently the contingent that wants to make art and look at classical texts and come together to make a world in that way was the same contingent of society that wanted to come together to fight monsters and calculate HP. Only now is that starting to be more, only in more recent years have those communities converged. I think every community comes up with ways to tell stories together. What those stories look like and what those methods look like can, of course, be really different. But I find myself really drawn to discover every community's stories.
You're listening to Troubadours and Rock on Tours with E.W. Conundrum Demure on WFTE Radio, Mount Cobb and Scranton, Pennsylvania. Community radio at its finest. Thank you. That was great. Annie Sanger.
Sanger, yeah, it's German.
And, yeah, it's a beautiful name. It has a nice ring to it. Here on Troubadours and Rock on Tours, escape artist, actress, and writer, among other things, escape artist. Now, is that tongue-in-cheek?
I mean, maybe, but also sort of true. Not literally. If you put me in a straitjacket, I will not be able to get out. However, I do sometimes feel like making a little window into a world, whether it's writing it or playing it with in a D&D game or through acting, it feels like cutting out a little window and just slipping into something else. Maybe not for the purpose of like saying this world is terrible, I want nothing to do with it, but definitely with the boon that I can then see into this world from a different angle.
I love it. I love it. Now, tell us about Hamlet, your Hamlet, yeah. Your one-woman Hamlet.
So my thesis in college for the theater studies major, there was a paper, of course. There's always a paper. But
yes, yes.
I had a wonderful professor named Deb Margolin, who is sort of famously was a voice in feminist theater and is still a voice in both feminist theater and like a solo performance. She's a playwright, she's a solo performer, she has a number of one-woman plays, and in junior year she and I discussed, and she suggested doing a one-woman reaction to the play we were both obsessed with. So I think of Hamlet, which has a question mark after it, so you have to sort of shrug your shoulders and lift your hands up and go, Hamlet? Like you don't know if that's the answer or not. Hamlet was I call it a version of and reaction to Hamlet, because it is in places rewritings of, and in places like Annie, fully as Annie, processing what it's like to interact with the play, and then everything in between. I wrote it over the course of a semester. We put on a production of it. And then a family friend who happened to work at a college saw it and commissioned me to come bring it there. And then recently I received a commission after performing it there to write another one. So I'm trying to work on that, but we'll see how it goes.
And the other one, is that also something connected to Shakespeare or something totally different?
For me, it would be. At the moment, I'm a little obsessed. My obsession has shifted from Hamlet to both Beatrice in Much Ado About Nothing and Katerina in Taming of the Shrew. So I'm playing with those and seeing what comes up as I start digging into the texts.
And when you write these, are they in line with the story and the characters of Hamlet, or are they, I mean, they must reference it.
How? That's a good question. It sometimes more so than other times. The first draft of Hamlet was definitely trying to echo the shape of the play. Subsequent drafts have moved further away from it. I would say it's structured more similarly to something I saw since I actually put Hamlet down for a while, a wonderful play called American Moor. Mm-hmm. It's sort of bits of writing from the personal and then bits of Shakespeare's text and then bits where it's an interpretation of. So, for example, rather than have scenes with an Ophelia, I romanced a dress form and wrote love letters to it. One as sort of like what Ophelia might see, or maybe the most cynical version of what Hamlet had to say to Ophelia. And then one as a sort of more earnest aspect of Hamlet really loving Ophelia, imagining how that love grew. And in between the two love letters was a moment where I was auditioning to play Ophelia and dealing with some of the truths of being a woman auditioning for authorities that are often male, but maybe not, just authorities that have an idea of what Ophelia should look like or what an actor should look like or who is allowed to play what part.
I love it. I really do. It sounds wonderful.
Thank you.
And from this point, I'm going to ask you where you're going to go next. But before we do that, do you want to share some contact information in case people want to keep track of what you're doing?
Yeah, definitely. You can find me on Facebook as Annie Sanger, AnnieSaenger, and same on Instagram. And then that one's Sanger Annie, but if you look me up, you should find me. And then, my professional email would be annie.sanger@gmail.com. Yeah.
And as I mentioned, I'm wondering where do you go from here?
Right now I'm working on a production of Measure for Measure. We actually had our first rehearsal last night. And so I'm playing Lucio in that. It's a wonderful small cast coming together to play a lot of parts and to make a Vienna that both exists as Vienna and as New York of the moment. It's a production that's fully delving into the contradictions in the script of who you are to yourself and who you are to society and what it is like to come into the world with a moral or logical understanding of the world and sort of a set of principles and then have those principles challenged by reality and have to reform them. And it's a really complex play and I'm really excited to tackle it.
Man, those are all questions that I'm wrestling with every day.
Yeah, right?
Honestly, before I was talking with you, I was dealing with something, you know, at the local police department. I got to call the police chief after our conversation, actually. I'm not in trouble. Don't get worried.
I will do my best not to.
But, you know, yeah, it's you have your ideals, if I understood you correctly. We all do. And then you have your reality. And how do you come to terms with all of that when they don't necessarily mesh well? You have, a great set of opportunities day to day, and you work hard, I'm sure, too, within your art. It's so invigorating to be living the way you're living, it sounds like to me. And I wish you the best, and I look forward to seeing some of what you're working on.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you for having me on to talk.
Oh, total pleasure. Total pleasure. I guess you and my associate producer, Dr. Michael Bavis, must have crossed paths somewhere.
We did. Actually, at the Fiasco workshop of A Streetcar Named Desire.
Oh, wonderful. Wonderful. Well, thank you for being so open to being on our program. And hopefully we get a chance to talk again in the not too distant future.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Take care, Annie.
Bye.
Settle down, ladies, settle down. And let's begin the annual Balboa Gold Rush and Fashion Bazaar. Mrs. Edwina Topeka, Mrs. Henry Hugo, Mrs.
Barbara. Trying to get on top, but it's never easy. Mastered my own luck, but it wasn't easy. Trying to feel alright around all these people. I try, but I'm just numb this time. Deepest cut, and I can't feel. Find my grip on the steering wheel. I know I can say it's stuck. You can sit down if you don't mind me standing up. I know I was too good to pass. Meeting you caused a change. You know the deal. Burnt, but it's still frying. Yeah, you know the deal. Can't redeem my love. It's such a steal. But you can't say I'm not trying this time.
Deepest cut that I can't feel. Find my grip on the steering.
Never see a chipmunk. Hey everybody, it's been a minute. Thanks for coming out. I haven't played out in public for a while. Now the ones who know me, hey Jer, Sammy, Simone, you guys know why I haven't been out. I guess I should tell the rest of you. My girl Marigold left me, and it's taken me a long time to get over it. I was a mess. I'd start sobbing wherever I happened to be. Walking in the park, standing in line at the grocery store, sitting in a coffee shop, even playing my guitar. One time I was walking down the street, and I stopped on the sidewalk and just started weeping. I couldn't move, and I couldn't stop weeping. So there was this guy cutting his grass, and he came over and hugged me, which was nice and all, but also a little weird. He hugged me longer and tighter than I thought was cool. Strange guy, but kind. Anyway, one day I came home from work. Forgot which job I had then. I think my brief gig at Staples. And all my stuff, my guitar, my knapsack, my Kerouac paperbacks, was packed up and piled up by the door. What gives? I asked Marigold. You're a self-absorbed jerk, and I can't stand being with you anymore, she said. Whoa, I said. Harsh. Now, she had said that to me before. Quite a few times, actually. But this is the first time she had ever piled up my stuff by the door. So I guess she saw some lyrics I wrote on the back of a paper bag from the farmer's market. And the song was about, well, sort of a girl I met at the farmer's market. Marigold didn't immediately flip, like she did when she saw the song I wrote on a popcorn box about a girl I met at the Cinemark, or when she found the song I wrote on a napkin about a girl I met after a show at a bar. Okay, well, that one had a phone number at the top of the napkin, so admittedly, that was a little sketchy. But they were just songs. That's what I told Marigold each time. You're my real muse. You're my girl. That's what I said to her. Can't tell you her response. Harsh. Sure, Marigold is a singer-songwriter like me, and as she's told me quite a few times, she doesn't want to be anybody's muse, and she doesn't want me writing songs for, / about, some chick I met buying kale at a produce stand. Hey, understood. She had other grievances, too, like how I always came home so late, and how I never washed the dishes, and how I sometimes didn't pay half of the rent, and how I never fed the cat, and how I spent the majority of my time smoking weed and listening to music, and how I generally just thought about myself and my songs. And I could hear the air quotes when she said songs. She had a pretty long list, and it was fairly accurate. In my defense, and this is what I said to her after she stopped yelling and waving the popcorn box at me, Marigold, I'm an artist. Well, as you might guess, that didn't go over well. I'm like Orpheus, Marigold, the dude who went to hell to rescue his dead girl Eurydice. And she said, you won't even go to the convenience store for me. I don't think she got my point. Maybe she just didn't get me. Anyway, we'd fight, make up, listen to music, play with the cat, and life would be normal for a while. But this last time, she wouldn't even listen to me. She left for work and told me to be gone by the time she got home. And she said she was keeping the cat. Although he was sort of mine. Or at least I named him. Cosmo. Cosmo the cat. Great cat. I miss him. So now I'm on Simone's couch. Not for long, Simone. Okay, so this first song I wrote like 10 minutes ago in the men's room. It's about chipmunks. I know, right? I go to the park almost every day, so Simone can have some private time with her man, Frank. Cool dude. Where is Frank, by the way? Anyway, when I'm at the park, I never see chipmunks. Squirrels everywhere, but never a chipmunk. So I wrote this song. It's about chipmunks, but it's also about love. You know, a metaphor. It's called, I Never See a Chipmunk. Hope you like it.
Well, the sun came up again today. Yeah.
Green Bush. Cigarettes and tattoos, blinking lights, breaking the rules. Skateboard on its side next to a light brown wooden table in my office. Plastic Buddha with a clear sphere in its lap next to a large gray-black rock on top of mulch and grass under a green bush 6 feet tall outside. I hear Alicia calling her children home for supper. I need to pick up my daughter from shopping with her friends at the mall. How does one not see all this beauty?
Blood on my shirt, 2 red buttons might have killed me that time. Oh, if I'd let him, he's slow and he's drunk and he lost his grip on me. Now I'm running down La Rue Saint-Paul, trying to get up from the weight of it all. Can't flag a car, I know he won't stop. I go see Persephone. Tap, tap, tapping on your window screen. Gotta let me in, Persephone. Got nowhere to go, but I had to get away from here. Well, my petals are bruised, but I'm still a flower. Come running to you in the violet eye. Put your skinny arms around me, let me taste your skin. Mouth to mouth, mouth to flower, salty sweet, you give me power. I feel you shake under my lips, your fingers tender, find my secrets. Don't make a sound, don't cry, your pants are sleeping just above. I kiss you once, I kiss you twice, fall asleep looking in each other's eyes. Tap, tap, tapping on your window screen. Gotta let me in, Persephone. Got nowhere to go, but I had to get away from here. All my petals are bruised, but I'm still a flower. Come running to you in the violet hour. Put your skinny arms around me, let me taste your skin. Light on your cheek, light telling me it's time to leave. The birds are calling to the morning, your parents' feet above us stirring. Kiss your bed before I go, climb back out of your basement window. Back to the cold spot, back to the hard life, back to the harsh bread street.
And there you have it, episode 482 of Troubadours and Rock On Tours, with yours truly, EW Conundrum Demure. I'd like to thank those folks who made this episode possible. First and foremost, Annie Sanger, our associate producer, Dr. Michael Pavese, and these musical artists: Thelonious Monk, Joe Walsh and Amjad Ali Khan, The Postal Service, Chaim, Joe Tolus, Allison Russell, Benford Marcellus, and Terrence Blanchard, too. And of course, I would like to thank you for listening. Until next time, let's give it a go and do our best with this time. Take care.